House Committee on Business and Labor. And we have one bill to take care of, some technical stuff, and then we'll go into our informational hearing. Open a work session, right?
Yes.
Senate Bill 640A.
Mr. Chair, I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 648.
Representative Cannon moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 640A. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
Do we have two-thirds?
Yeah, we have two-thirds. No. Oh.
We are right at 7, so yes, we're fine. We are fine.
Good. Now, we have a bunch of bankers there. We'll do the math for us if we need. Okay.
You can do math.
Seeing no opposition, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 640A was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Cam moves we can reconsider the vote by which 640A was sent for a due pass recommendation as amended. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which the Dash A3's amendments dated on 5-8-09 were adopted.
Representative Cam moves reconsider the vote by which the committee adopted Dash A3 amendments dated 5-8-09. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the A4 amendments dated 5-22 to Senate Bill 640.
Representative Cameron moves to adopt Dash A4 amendments dated 5-22-09. Teresa, would you explain to us what we're
doing? Yes, Mr. Chair, in the audience, the reason why we had to reconsider the vote for Senate Bill 640A is because there were conflict amendments with House Bill 2910, which we passed earlier this session. Specifically, the Dash 8-4 contains everything in the Dash 8-3, which we did adopt. The conflict amendment is in dealing with ORS 696280, which is in both measures. And what it does is, in Senate Bill 640, it maintains the reference to sole proprietor, and House Bill 2910 removes the term sole proprietor from Oregon real estate law. So the conflict amendments resolve that issue.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher, we are moving the Dash A4 into 640A to remove conflicts with other measures. Do you have any? The motion is to amend.
Okay.
All right. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. Representative.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 640 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 640A to the floor as amended, due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. What was the vote on this in the Senate?
It was unanimous, Mr. Chair. So we did assign a carry. Unfortunately, my computer is not working, so I don't have that. So we can maintain the original.
Okay, that's fine.
The committee's comfortable with that.
All right, well, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 640A. We're going to open an informational hearing on, among other things, usage of Troubled Asset Relief Program, better known as TARP funds, by Oregon banks. And before I invite these nice people up here, I rarely guarantee anything because there is no guarantees. You can't make any promises around here to anybody. But I did say on the House floor, if this bill didn't, which I oppose this bill because I found it unnecessary, because I knew we extended a nice, gracious invitation to our neighbors in the banking industry that they would show up and talk to us about not just TARP money, but any money. And they have responded in kind. So that's why we're here. And Representative Shields was invited. He called me last night. He's with his little girl today, which is far more important than anything we do in this building. So that's why he's not present. Representative Cameron is excused for other business, if I'm not wrong.
That's correct.
So I'd like to call just these three.
Actually, Mr. Chair, we can bring up all five. I just need to move the microphone
okay.
over.
Okay. So Linda Navarro, Steve Philpott, Mike Stevenson, David Wind. Thank you, David. Lark Wisham. And thank you for coming today. I really appreciate it. And members, after they talk about TARP funds, if you feel free to ask them questions about the finance industry, the situation in the world, the economy, whatever is at your on top of your head. I really do want to appreciate you all for coming here today. Express my appreciation for you all coming here today. Whenever you're ready, Linda.
Okay. Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, I do want to thank you very much for inviting us today. It's obviously been a year where banking has been in the news, where everyone, whether it's a banker or a customer of a bank, member of the Oregon business community, Linda Navarro, President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association. So Oregon Bankers Association is the full-service trade association that represents the banking industry in the state of Oregon. And one of the things I wanted to start out with is a clarification of what the Oregon banking industry is. When I talk about Oregon banks, I'm talking about FDIC-insured depository institutions that are highly regulated, that have branch presence in their local communities, and that have a holistic relationship with their customers, meaning not only do they make loans to their customers, but they very much value the deposits of their local customers. These are different from the unregulated or underregulated financial companies that have often been referred to as banks in recent months and really throughout the past year. In addition to this panel of Oregon bankers that has joined me here today, we do have some other Oregon bankers in the room, and I appreciate them coming. So we have quite a sampling of Oregon bankers from banks large and small, state chartered and nationally chartered, here with us today. I'm going to begin with a few remarks about the industry as a whole and highlight a couple of handouts that you have and then turn it over to our panel. Real quickly, in Oregon, there are 58 banks doing business in the state of Oregon, and 34 of those are state-chartered banks that have the state of Oregon and the FDIC or the Fed as their primary regulator. So that's 59% of the banks that do business in Oregon. And in addition to that, of course, we have national banks, OTS banks. We have 9 banks doing business in the state of Oregon that are headquartered in the state of Washington. So there's a lot of diversity in our industry, and certainly the customer always wins from diversity in the industry. It gives them choice where they can do business. It's a very competitive marketplace, and there's lots of options and choices for consumers that want to shop around where they choose to have their deposits held and where they go to obtain their loans. We have banks in Oregon. Clackamas County Bank comes to mind as being over 100 years old and still operating under the name of Clackamas County Bank. And I point this out because the history and tradition of banks in their local community is important. They are the economic engine in their community, and they are the chief source of credit to small business in their community. And they continue to be in this market even though it's very challenging today. So real quickly on the subject of lending. Last year, we actually, believe it or not, and in your materials, you have some charts, particularly in the bound printed purple folder, some statistics that show that in 2008, lending, small business, large business, and consumer lending actually increased. And we were in a recession, whether people acknowledged it or not, in 2008. We don't expect to have that same level of growth in 2009. In a recession, you always have a constriction of demand. Demand goes down as businesses retrench. But also, there's certain sectors that are harder. It's just harder to get a loan. For example, if you're a land development or construction company right now in this current housing market, it is more challenging to obtain a loan. But overall, our banks are still lending, and they can talk more specifically about that. I do want to mention a little bit about the state chartered banks. Our state charter banks in Oregon, which the state has primary supervisory authority over, along with, as I said, the FDIC and the Fed, they're focused on small business, number one, almost all of them. Some have a retail presence, consumer-focused, but most are very much focused on small business. They're also a reflection of the communities they serve. So there's some geographic influences, particularly related to the housing market, that affect certain banks. Also, these banks, when I talk about community banks, are not what you've heard of as systemically significant. They're largely on their own, doing their very best to continue to serve Oregon's communities, as they have in many cases for decades. Many of our banks in Oregon remain profitable. Most are still rated very well by the regulators, but we do have some challenges, and I want to clearly acknowledge that. Particularly banks that have a lot of exposure in construction and land development, they weren't making subprime loans or toxic mortgage loans, but they were lending in the housing boom to a lot of developers, and some of these banks are really challenged with their assets right now. On top of that, capital expectations are increasing from regulators. That can affect lending. Liquidity concerns are paramount for any bank that's feeling some stress. And overall, some of these banks, particularly when you get into, when you're going down the road, and I liken it to you're progressing quite nicely, but then you go off the road, kind of go over the lip. Your goal is to get back, correct yourself and get back on the road. But what some of our banks have expressed is that once they go off the road, they feel like they're being pushed into the ditch to some degree by accounting rules and certain regulatory pressures. So we've been working intensely most recently with our national regulators, and I'm talking about the federal application of federal regulation. We just were back in Washington, D.C., meeting with them on our top 10 things regulators could do now to support Oregon community banking. So I will tell you, we're actively advocating for treatments and regulations that allow all Oregon banks to weather this current downturn, to correct their course if they have gone off the road, and to be here to serve Oregon communities for years to come. We have had two failures in the state of Oregon this year of community banks. The depositors in both those cases were protected, insured and uninsured deposits, actually by the acquisition of those deposits by banks, both of which are represented today on this panel. And we do have an orderly system for resolution in the case of a bank failure. And that's important to note in the FDIC-insured depository institutions. There is an orderly system to protect depositors, and there still is no safer place to put your money than in an FDIC-insured institution, because no depositor has ever lost a penny, even in the worst economic times, in an FDIC, of an insured deposit in an FDIC-insured institution. TARP, I know, is a subject of interest, and these banks will talk about their involvement in TARP, but I will remind you and let you know that in your packet there's plenty of material to validate this. Any bank that received TARP, particularly the four banks headquartered in Oregon, and those are the ones that we've been discussing with all of you lately, they received TARP funds under one program. There's multiple programs under the Treasury right now. It's the Capital Purchase Program. The Capital Purchase Program is a program, you can look in the material, you can go on the website, it's available to viable, healthy institutions. They have to apply and receive that capital. Then, on top of their regulators that they already have in place, they have to submit monthly reports to the SIGTARP, which is the Special Inspector General for TARP recipients, that was organized to oversee how these funds are lent back out and dispersed in their communities. So there's substantial reporting and oversight in place. And we gave you just a fraction. This is the most recent report issued last month to Congress by SIGTARP.
We don't need
we
that.
Gave you a fraction of it. But the point being that it's very transparent program with substantial federal oversight, and I want to emphasize that because every bank in this room has reported on their that has TARP funds, has reported on those funds, and is happy to share that information with you. It's available on aggregate and individual basis, and there's a website called financialstability.org or gov. financialstability.gov, I think. You can go there anytime and check out all the information you ever wanted to know about who's received TARP funds and how that's being lent back out. So I'm going to close and turn it over to my colleagues by telling you that today, actually, the FDIC issued their press release on first quarter 09 performance, and I thought that was timely since we were here today. And one of Sheila Bair, the chairman of the FDIC's comments that I thought was a pretty appropriate summary, not only for the national banking industry but for Oregon banks, was that banks are making good efforts to deal with the challenges they're facing, but today's report says that we're not out of the woods yet. She added, as I see it, we're now in the cleanup phase for the banking industry. And again, it really depends on what bank, where they're located, and what kind of loans they had. But she said, we're in the cleanup phase for the banking industry. It will take some more time, but in the end, we'll have a stronger banking industry that's better able to meet the demand for credit as the economy recovers. So my closing remark is, I mean, it's my job to be concerned about the banking community and its future in this state. But we have a long and rich history, as I said. Our banks continue to serve as the chief source of credit for businesses in our community, and we need, as Oregonians, we need them to continue to do that for years to come. And we need banks of all sizes. Consolidation is going to be inevitable to some degree, but it's in the best interest of Oregonians to have diversity in our financial system and to have choices for consumers, to have competition among our financial institutions. So we appreciate the regulators and our lawmakers acknowledging the role that Oregon banks play in our community and supporting our ability to weather this economic downturn and move forward. Thank you. And I'd be happy to answer questions or wait until after.
Before we go to the rest of the panel, I just, when things go to hell in a handbasket, no matter what you're doing, it's easy to sit around and go, holy moly, they should have done this, that, and that. Well, okay. And there's been a lot of pretty serious changes being made in Washington, D.C. and in this building to stabilize this economy and our lending industry. I've spent all those happy days with you and Tim and others with Representative Hovey and Senator Bonamici at the Mortgage Lending Workgroup and learned more about that than I ever wanted to know. And it's a complex, wound-up ball of string for me, a simple guy. But my concern about all this was, I can't remember how many hundred of million we got. The number 280 sticks out of my brain for some reason that have come to these four institutions in Oregon. When I read in the paper that there was going to be public stigma attached to this and that one of the presidents was going to send that back to Washington in the depth of this recession, and we need investment in this state more than ever, it would be irresponsible for this body to take action to cause that to happen when we need that money infused into this economy. It just defies logic. So if you would speak specifically to that money, if you can, and if you want to expand on it, that'd be great, because that was the intent of this bill. And I know you guys and gals can explain it all to us, but for the life of me, I could not understand the logic behind that. But I'll quit beating up on that, and Glenda, if you want to summarize, and then we'll go to these nice people.
Sure, thank you, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. Just two other quick points. You mentioned changes. This week was one of the hearings on regulatory restructuring for the financial services industry, and one of the things our industry is advocating for is regulatory parity among different types of financial institutions, and we would like to see the under-regulated financial institutions that were engaged, whether in mortgage lending or in the securitization market, investment banks, subject to standards, if not the same as commercial and savings savings banks to some level commensurate with the risk that they are posing as financial institutions. So that's an important activity occurring in Congress right now, and it will have broad sweeping effects on us for years to come. The other quick point I'll say is with regard to TARP, I failed to mention that under the capital purchase program, those funds have come to Oregon banks through a preferred stock investment by the government in those banks. And those funds are paying dividends to the government now, and they will be repaid to the government. So it's a stimulus program in our local communities that actually potentially will yield a financial gain to the government and to the taxpayer. But it's been met, as you said, with a stigma that surprised us all and certainly has been disappointing and is counter to the otherwise positive comments that folks have made about stimulus money flowing into this state. It's probably the most financially advantageous stimulus funds to flow into the state. It's leveraged 7 to 10 times in the form of loans, and yet for some reason it's been viewed as some sort of bailout, which in fact it's completely different than the bailout of a company like AIG.
So. There's no shortage in stigma on logging, water use, ranching, farming, construction, development, flexible land use, so you're not alone.
Please, let's go on before I shoot my mouth off.
Gravel, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Linda.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Philpott. I'm Executive Vice President and General Counsel of Umpqua Bank and Umpqua Holdings Corporation. Thank you very much for the opportunity and the invitation to appear here this morning and talk to you a little bit about our company. Umpqua Bank was founded in 1953 in Canyonville. We are the largest bank headquartered in Oregon. We have about $8.6 billion in assets these days. We have about 150 branches spread throughout Northern California, Oregon, and Southwest Washington. The administrative, the headquarters, frankly, for the bank is still in Roseburg. The holding company headquarters are in Portland. Most of our administrative functions, as well as the majority of our branches, are in Oregon. We were asked by our regulators in October of this past year to make application to the capital purchase program. We had been looking at private capital at that point in time. At that point in time, we were well capitalized. We had over 11% in capital, but our regulators said, look, we want you to be super capitalized, Umpqua Bank, because we want you to be in a position to continue aggressive lending programs to help our small and medium-sized businesses get through this recession. And we also want you to be on the sidelines available to help us at the FDIC deal with troubled banks that have to be closed down. I'm here to tell you this morning that we have done both of those things. With regard to bank closures, we did assume the insured deposits of the Bank of Clark County in January when it was closed by the FDIC. But the main point that I want to make this morning is that, like all of the community banks here today, we are a margin bank. We make our money on the difference between what we charge for our loans and what we pay on our deposits. And that's our lifeblood, and we don't have to be encouraged or beat over the head by anybody to make loans. If we're not making loans, we're not making money. So, and that's true of all of our community banks. We leverage the capital that we have. We don't loan our capital, but we loan our deposits, and it's supported by our capital base. And so the inflow of deposits to our banks and our ability to make quality loans is key to our success. We were the 14th bank in the country to be approved under the capital purchase program, and we closed in the second tranche of fundings on November 14th. And this program was initially sold to us and is still referred to by the Treasury as a program for strong, healthy banks. And that's why we participated. It was capital that was well-priced from our standpoint. It came with some strings attached back in October, but those were strings that we thought we could live with, and we are living with. And the problem is that these days the rules seem to change almost every day with regard to the program, largely in response to the prevailing political winds back in Washington, D.C. Let me talk a little bit about our lending activities. In Q1 of this year, our mortgage activity was really off the charts. Closed mortgage loan volume was $192 million, up 172% from the $70 million closed in Q4 of 2008. Of this volume, 70% was refinance and 30% was new home purchase. Regardless, even if we're talking about refinance, we're talking about a lot of people who were able to refinance their mortgages and reduce the monthly payments that they're making on their mortgages, and thereby put more money in their pockets and hopefully out into the economy as we move forward. Our Achilles heel, frankly, at Umpqua Bank was residential development lending. We had a lot of that in Sacramento. We had not a lot, but enough in Bend. And those were two markets that were very hard hit in the housing downturn. We have spent the last 2 years really working through that portfolio. We really closed down and started to close off our residential development lending in 2006. And we saw it start to hit us in about Q2 of 2007. And all the way through 2008, and here we are in 2009, and we're still working through those loans. As of March 31, our construction loan totals decreased 5% from the end of 2008 and 21% from March of 2008. So we're still reducing that exposure. Our gross loan fundings in Q1 were $455 million, which is really quite a good number. It was offset by paydowns of $444 million and charge-offs of $55 million, so resulting in an overall decline of outstandings compared with the end of the year, but the gross loan fundings were pretty robust. Even so, our total loans and leases were $100 million above Q108 numbers at the end of the first quarter of this year. We've announced a number of lending initiatives since the first of this year. We do have a very qualified lending group that focuses on the wine industry in the Napa and Sonoma Valleys, and we are expanding that expertise into Oregon and Washington to help our wine industries here. We have a Green Street lending program, which involves creation of an eco-banking group that specializes in financing energy-efficient and alternative energy programs, and we have a partnership with the Energy Trust of Oregon for some of those programs. And then we also have tailored financing for local governments to meet infrastructure and operational needs. As a community bank, we are very actively involved in our communities. One of our most successful programs is our Connect Volunteer Program. Any full-time employee at Umpqua Bank is entitled to take up to 40 hours per year to use for volunteer service in the community during normal work hours, and we pay their normal salary and wages during that period of time. Last year, 2008, we had almost 26,000 hours contributed and paid for through our Connect program. And that's been a very successful, very well received by our employees. We have traditionally ranked very high in the we were in the have been in for 3 years, I think it is, in the Fortune list of 100 best companies to work for, as well as our local publications have ranked us very high as well as far as employee satisfaction, basically, with, working with Umpqua Bank. And I do have some examples of our community giving, but I won't go into detail on those, but happy to provide those offline if that information is of interest to any member of the committee. So that's a little bit about who we are, what we're doing. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to entertain those.
Glad to hear you didn't bury all that money in a mason jar. So, go ahead. Let's just finish up with the panel, and then we'll open up the questions.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm David Wind. I'm manager of community relations for U.S. Bank in Portland. I'm here for Malia Wasson, our market president, who's president of the bank in Oregon and Southwest Washington. She's out of state this week. So actually a similar story, just slightly larger numbers. Although the U.S. Bank headquarters is now in Minneapolis, Oregon is home to U.S. Bank. It's where the name started. And as an institution, we've been doing business in the state for more than 100 years. We're the largest bank in the state of Oregon by deposits and number of branches. We have 186 branches in almost every corner of the state. Nationally, we're the sixth largest bank. We have branches, 2,847 branches in 24 states. If you draw a line from San Diego to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, we're in pretty much everything that's north and west of that line. $163 billion in deposits across the country. And so in those branches, we're operating consumer and business banking operations. We have a national trust services and wholesale banking business, and we have a global payment services and merchant processing business, which is just a fancy way of saying it's a big credit card business. Our mission as a company is we put the power of us, U.S., that's kind of a marketing catchy thing, to work for you. And there are really four ways in which we do that, and I wanted to just mention those briefly. We engage our employees. We have 4,700 employees in the state of Oregon. We increase value for our shareholders. We're a publicly traded company. That's what we have to do. We deepen service and relationships for our customers, and we build our communities. And I want to return to that community building ethic, but I think it's important that that is an explicit part of our mission. So just to talk real briefly about TARP, as you've heard from us already, it is an investment. It's not a bailout. It's certainly not a handout. The U.S. Treasury invested those funds, and I think it's important to remember what was going on in October and November. Things have calmed down a little since then, but at the time that program was put in place, the financial systems were starting to unravel. There were things that people take for granted, like commercial paper markets, like banks being able to lend to each other, that were jamming up, and there was a systemic risk of things spiraling out of control. So one of the primary motivations for that whole program was to stabilize the bank system and restore confidence. U.S. Bank sold $6.6 billion of preferred stock to the U.S. Treasury. As you've heard, we're paying a 5% annual dividend on that. Each quarter we pay dividends to them. And the U.S. Treasury owns warrants, which give them the right to purchase stock in U.S. Bank at a price that was fixed at the time of the TARP financing being put in place. A recent estimate I heard from one of our vice chairs is that the current value of the Treasury's warrants in U.S. Bank, for example, is somewhere between $200 and $300 million. So in addition to the dividends, there's also a profit and a gain being made on those warrants. So how do we use the money? Well, we're open for business, contrary to any rumors. We were profitable in the first quarter. We made $529 million of profit in the first quarter, and we reported record revenue for the quarter. Deposits are up, and loans are up. Our first quarter press release is 60 pages of words and numbers, and I will spare you a recitation of every single one of them. But as I say, loans and deposits are up across the board. I think what we and my colleagues here would say is one of the things we've seen is what we refer to as a flight to quality. People are concerned about the stability of the financial institution they do business with, where they have their money on deposit, and those of us who are strong have benefited from that. I'll focus on two specific sets of numbers in that whole 60 pages worth. We have an SBA division that exclusively makes SBA loans. The outstandings under that program increased every quarter in 2008 and increased in the first quarter of 2009. So at the end of the quarter, we had more SBA loans outstanding than we did at the beginning of the quarter. On residential mortgages, those also increased over the same period, and again, we had more residential mortgage loans on the books at the end of the first quarter than we did at the beginning, and our mortgage loan production as a company across our franchise was $13.4 billion in the first quarter. We don't break these numbers out by state, but I can tell you a couple of things to give you a perspective. In our residential mortgage origination business, we were hiring temporary staff in the first quarter, and based on my conversations with the staff in that business, I'm not sure if they're actually sleeping at the moment because they are so busy that they're pretty much working 24/7. And as far as SBA loans are concerned, the bank has an outstanding CRA rating in the Portland area, and the Portland MSA is the number one ranked SBA market in the country for U.S. Bank. So we're using the money as I think people would want us to. As my colleague from Umpqua mentioned, the other important thing that this capital did was it provided a place for the FDIC to turn when there were banks that failed. In the case of U.S. Bank, there have been three organizations, none of which happened to be in the state of Oregon. But in November 2008, the Office of Thrift Supervision closed down Downey Savings and PFF, who are primarily have 213 branches, $12 billion in deposits, almost all in California, some in Arizona. They closed those banks down on a Friday, and it was a holiday weekend. And on Tuesday morning, when those depositors wanted to go into the bank to access their funds, U.S. Bank was operating those institutions. So that stability, I think, is incredibly important. And the other thing that's important is there's 500,000 customers of those two organizations who, through U.S. Bank, now have access to the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac programs to modify their single-family mortgage loans and to work with a healthy financial institution to hopefully reduce foreclosure. And then in April of 2009, we took over the assets of First Bank of Idaho, which is an 8-branch, $200 million organization. Same story, the bank closed on Friday, and on Monday morning it was open under different control. The other thing you may have heard about that impacted U.S. Bank in the last several months was the stress test. This was an exercise that the Treasury and the regulators went through with the 19 largest financial institutions. They weren't all regulated banks. They included all kinds of other organizations as well. And what that exercise involved was looking at loan portfolio data, for everything from credit cards to large wholesale loans, forecasting losses under a set of increasingly adverse economic assumptions, and then determining the capital adequacy of those institutions to handle those losses. U.S. Bank was one of the three banks in that group to pass the stress test, which meant that the outcome of that was to say, you do not need to raise additional capital. Having said that, because the markets have stabilized somewhat, U.S. Bank has, in the last several weeks, been out into the public equity markets and sold stock and raised $2.5 billion of equity and placed $1 billion of 5-year debt. And it is highly likely that those proceeds will be used to repay the TARP financing when the Treasury is willing and able to accept repayment. I wanted to mention briefly something about community service. You heard, again, from my colleague at Umpqua about that. It is integral to U.S. Bank. When I joined the company 18 years ago, it was made very clear to me that one of the obligations was to get involved in the community. And our employees lend their time, their talent, and their resources to support community organizations. One of the many pieces of paper in your packet is a one-page extract from the Portland Business Journal last year, which ranked the largest companies in the state by their giving to not-for-profit organizations. U.S. Bank gave, in cash, $2.8 million to not-for-profit organizations during the course of the year. And as I say, our employees are involved significantly with their time to support those organizations. And finally, the thing I wanted to echo something Linda said about what happens in the current environment when people want to borrow money. There's a number of questions that bankers ask when somebody wants to borrow money in order to underwrite the loan. And one of those questions is, how are you going to pay us back? And the second, and another question is, what happens if that doesn't work? What's the secondary source of repayment? What kind of collateral do you have? And it is fair to acknowledge that in the current economic environment, the way that people, the information that people have to answer those questions is not as good today as it was 12 months ago. People, companies are not making as much money as they did, and collateral, whether it's an investment portfolio or a piece of real estate, is not worth as much as it was. So that does mean that it is sometimes harder for people to borrow money right now. That's not because banks are not willing to lend money. It's because if we apply the same reasonable thresholds for underwriting a loan, as we always have done, then we're going to come up with different answers right now. And that's a reflection of economic circumstances and not a reflection of a lack of capital or a lack of willingness to loan money.
Mr. Wine, folks, we have floor at 10:15. The last two folks, if you could summarize, I want these folks, if they want to ask any questions, ask some time for questions. So, let's just summarize. What you have to say is important, but we are on a time schedule here, so forgive me. I probably let the first three go too long.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Stevenson. I'm the CEO of Capital Pacific Bank. And some of you I've seen just a few weeks ago here in the same room, I believe. We are a six-year-old community bank based in Portland. My numbers are a little bit different than David's, perhaps a little bit on the smaller side, but we're a $140 million bank. We are a single location operation working and focused on local businesses in the Portland market, and that would include a special focus on nonprofit organizations, professional firms, and property management companies. Nonprofit organizations represent our single largest sector of clients, and it represents about 30% of our deposit base. We are a strong bank. We have a strong capital base. We had a strong capital base prior to applying for TARP last fall. We also have remained profitable through this economic downturn, although I will say that, it's been stressful out there. It is hard, and there's stress that all banks are feeling. But we've been able to manage to remain profitable, well-capitalized. And one of the reasons that we're able to remain profitable and have lower levels of non-performing assets than other banks is due to the fact that we're well-diversified in our loan portfolio. We do not have the same levels of concentration in commercial real estate than some of other banks had. To put that in numbers, it's less than 5% of our loans. And believe me, that less than 5% of our loans is very painful. But residential development loans is something that we fortunately had a low level of. We applied for TARP as soon as the program was announced. We looked at the program, and for similar reasons that Steve mentioned, it was attractively priced capital. But it also fit a need that for our bank that seemed to match up well with what the government intended through the use of TARP, and that is that we already, as I mentioned, had a strong capital ratio of about 13%. We'd raised equity in the private markets about a year ago, and that boosted our capital to 13%, which we thought was a good number for us to have. We had some strategic planning last October with our board management team and asked a few questions, one of which was, what do we think about the outlook for the economy? And that was very across-the-board negative. Everyone had a dismal outlook to the economy. And we said, given our view on the economy, what level of capital should we maintain going into this? And we liked where we were at 13%. Put that in perspective, 10% is what you need to be well-capitalized, considered by the regulators. So we were well in excess of that, but we felt that was a good margin cushion to have going into a rough economy. But we also knew we wanted to grow the bank. And so the TARP fit in very nicely with that, and so we applied for TARP and received an additional amount of capital that allowed us to use that money to support our growth. So I think in terms of what the intent of TARP was, it lined up very well in terms of what our goals were in the use of TARP. How we've been using TARP is, as I mentioned, there's, and Linda pointed out, there's a lot of reporting that we do to the government today. But for us, our loan originations are about, again, these numbers are a lot smaller than what David points out for our bank. In the first quarter, $7 million of new loan originations and $18 million of renewals, which is in the aggregate up higher than what it was a year ago for the same period. We did have also loan payoffs. Some of those we were glad to see go away because they were troubled situations, moving sometimes into an asset-based lender's hands. We also had we were talking about loan demand being down. Our credit line utilization is down about 6% in a quarter-over-quarter basis. That means that companies are using less of their lines of credit and paying them down as they are really hunkering down and maybe not having as much in the way of capital needs. We also look at our pipeline going forward, and it's pretty consistent with our past history. There's about $7 million of loans that we have in the pipeline that would be booking over the next 90 days. So we would like to grow even more quickly. The only constraint that we have is our ability to raise deposits. The sectors that we're focused on tend to be more deposit-oriented, and the regulators tend to get a little bit out of shape if we are going to, as we would as well, if we were to go out and use borrowed funds to be able to fund new loans. So really, capital is not our constraint. It's really deposits. And as quickly as we can raise deposits, we'll deploy them into loans. But today we are, I think, using TARP funds as intended.
Thank you.
I'll move along quickly.
Last but not least.
Good morning, Chairman Schaffler and committee members. My name is Lark Weisham. I'm Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of Citizens Bank in Corvallis, Oregon. I'm also the current chair of the Oregon Bankers Association. I've also been in banking for over 30-some years, and I've seen economic cycles. I have lived through prime rate being 22%, and now I've lived through the Fed's funds being 0%. So I've seen a lot, and this is probably one of the toughest that we've experienced in our industry. Citizens Bank is a 52-year-old community bank headquartered in Corvallis, Oregon. We have 13 branches in Willamette Valley. Until we took over a failed bank, we were about $350 million in assets. We're now around $450. We are a traditional community bank whose core business is taking deposits and making loans to individuals and businesses in our market areas. Our focus is on the business community. We did not make any of the subprime mortgages that you hear about that got so many non-bank financial institutions in trouble, and those institutions are not regulated in the same way as the banking industry. We are close to our customers in our bank. In fact, when we saw the economy going bad in some of our communities, we asked every single one of our loan officers to look at their loan portfolio and personally visit every business customer to make sure that the lines of communications were open. We wanted to get to them before they got in trouble. We wanted to be able to sit down with them, restructure their loan, talk about doing business differently. And we, in fact, did that. We got out to every single one of those business customers and had a conversation. Our goal was to help both of us survive the economic downturn and to provide jobs and economic opportunities in the community we serve. We did, in fact, look at all the relationships, and we are working with those customers that are struggling, and we certainly do have customers that are struggling in this economic times, business customers that 2 years ago were doing fine and now find themselves struggling. We feel it's in our best interest, the interest of the community and the interest of that customer, to work together as a team to restructure their debt and to help them work out of whatever financial problems they're having. We are making loans, despite what you hear in the news. We grew our loan portfolio by over $26 million last year, or 9.6%. So far in the first 4 months of this year, almost five, we've grown loans over $20 million, and that's average loans. And so that is terrific growth for the size of our bank. We also increased our donations of cash and employee time off on the job to be involved in the community. We got together when we did our budget this year and rearranged some of our deposits to gear them toward maybe more low income, more of the food banks, and instead of cutting our donations both in time and cash, we decided it was a time to step up and improve that to help our companies. Even though we knew it would have a small impact on our bottom line, we felt that was important to our communities. We believe that our involvement in the community is important to both the community and to us. We are a partner with the communities that we serve. Citizens Bank is a very safe and sound bank. Some have called our bank ultra-conservative. Actually, that has done well for us in the economic turndown. We have very strong capital. And in that regard, we were able to acquire the failed Silver Falls Bank in Silverton, Oregon City, and Salem. No Silver Falls Bank customer lost any deposit money. The FDIC system works. The economy is giving the banking community its challenges, and some in our states are suffering more than others. The banking community in Oregon is working hard to survive the economic downturn, as our customers are. One of the biggest challenges to the Oregon banking community and to our bank is liquidity. Liquidity in all banks is a challenge. That comes from increased fees from the state of Oregon, increased FDIC assessments, pressure from regulators to increase our capital levels, unfair competition from non-bank entities, and more continues to put pressure on for all banks, not just banks in Oregon. It's liquidity that we use to make loans, and that's where we're having the pressures, and they're coming for all different sizes. Despite all the pressures in the current economic environment, the banking community is committed to lending in the communities we serve. I think one person on our team mentioned our business is taking deposits, making loans, making good loans so they pay us back, but we protect that margin. Whatever we pay on deposits and we earn on loans, there has to be a margin to cover overhead and build capital. That's the nature of our business. As OBA chair, I want you to know that we greatly appreciate support of the Oregon public policymakers in recognizing the important role that Oregon banks play in our communities. We are committed to the financial strength of this state and our businesses. It is important to have your support as we walk through the difficult and economically challenging times. It is important to have your support as we work through those problems and the problems we see in the financial health of our customers. I thank you for your time, and I'm sure any of us will be happy to answer any questions you have.
I have one question. That 60 or whatever page report that you have to provide to that inspector, is that a public document?
Yeah, that the 60-page document I referred to is our first quarter press release.
So if someone wants to get down, it's a press release. If someone wants to get down in the weeds on where this money's going and who's getting it and who's using it and how.
That's on our website.
All accessible.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah,
and the financial, Chair Schaffler, the financialstability.org or gov website,
right.
I can't remember, okay. Has it all.
Right. Thank you very much. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for...
Can I add one thing to that?
Yes, please, go ahead.
The SIGTARP documents are public documents. In fact, we received a letter from SIGTARP indicating that some of the information that we had would be confidential information about clients, and so we were asked to strike certain portions of our response because it is a public document.
Right, I understand. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being here today to help explain what's going on. I just want to be clear. So if you took TARP money, that came for all the banks that took it in a preferred stock sale that pays 5.5%
five percent
to the U.S. government.
5% for 5 years, and then it ratchets up to 9%.
Which is an incentive to repay it.
Okay. The if I may, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Yeah. The I think Mr. Wyden, you referred to the. When the Treasury is willing and able to accept repayment. Can you talk about, first of all, I know my deposits in your bank, not with you, but are not getting 5%. Can you talk about when you can pay that money back or if they're able to pay it back?
The situation, as we understand it, is there are... certainly amongst the larger institutions, it's at this point at the discretion of the Treasury as to when they will accept repayment. So U.S. Bank is one of the institution that has indicated a willingness to repay that preferred stock investment and pay off the warrants. But it's up to the U.S. Treasury at this point to say whether or not they're willing to accept that repayment.
Please.
Yeah. Owning preferred stock in Fannie Mae and getting a 5% dividend that went away, can you, on normal preferred stock, and just maybe for the committee members, and we have some students from high school, on normal preferred stock, can you call it, or can you pay, can you do anything with your preferred stock that's not owned by the government? Can you call it in, or
it depends? It depends on
Treasury. Make a Treasury stock out of it.
Yeah, it depends. It's all dependent upon the terms of the issuance. Any issuance of securities has a specific set of conditions attached to it. So, with the bank's common stock, with the regular stock that everybody could own on a regular basis, the bank can go into the open market and buy that stock back and retire it. With the preferred stock that's part of the TARP program, it's ambiguous, as I understand it, as to what the redemption terms are. But at this point, our understanding is that we have to, we have to get the approval of Treasury to be able to repay it. One of the challenges, as you heard from one of my colleagues, is that the strings that come with the TARP money are not cast in concrete. So to the extent that the Treasury can now come back and say, well, in addition to the restrictions that we place on your organization at the time that you accepted that money, we're also going to ask some other things of you. So there's some incentive for folks who have now been able to raise additional capital to repay that money and operate sort of fully independently from the Treasury.
Right. Well, I'll make a comment. We're a bank that didn't take TARP, and one of the reasons we didn't, because it looked good to us. It was cheap capital. We could have used it. We had enough loan demand that would have been nice to have that extra funds. What we recognized is that it was too open-ended. When the government issued that, it was all one way, and it was the government's way, and we recognized that they could change the rules on us, and we are so conservative. One thing, we didn't want the government involved in our bank, and two, we got very concerned when we read it that the rules could change, and the rules changed from it being a very positive program for banks, and it still should be looked at that way, to now what we're going through, that banks that took it are getting some grief over it, and it shouldn't be that way. But we recognize that concern, and we did not take it because of that.
One more follow-up.
So really, Steve, you don't know if you could ever pay it back today, even before the five-year limit is up when it goes to 9%. The government could say, no, we're not taking the money back.
I don't know the program well enough to be able to fully answer that, but I think I think there is a provision after 3 years that for repayment. But the primary question at this point is whether or not, under what circumstances. And there has been an indication from the Treasury that they've accepted repayment from some smaller institutions. That the larger issue is with some of the larger banks, when and if they would be willing to do that. And there's some indication that in the next month or so that will be a lot clearer than it is right now.
That's correct. Under the original Treasury agreement that we have, we can repay it after 3 years. What changed was with the stimulus bill that was passed here in January, I think it was, Representative Frank inserted a provision that would allow banks that receive CPP, Capital Purchase Program money, to repay it before the three-year period if they had the approval of their primary regulators. And there's it makes some sense, because obviously our primary regulators wanted us to become supercapitalized last fall. Things aren't remarkably better now than they were then, so they would have to give their approval to, in essence, reduce our capital levels or see what our plan is for replacing that capital.
Thank you.
Representative Rich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for conducting this hearing. I'm trying to, and thank you all for for being here today. I'm trying to reconcile a well-known fact that the economy is down, unemployment is up, so presumably commerce isn't quite as robust now. You folks have had to be conservative with your lending practices. Loans at least are up among the four banks represented here. I'm trying to reconcile some seemingly irreconcilable sets of facts. I mean, where is the money going, and who's growing so I can tell my constituents to go there to find a job?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Navarro, Oregon Bankers, and I think an important fact that's not often understood around credit availability is in the 1980s, the banking industry, the traditional banks that I referenced, are constituted about 60 to 70% of all credit that was available. Today, going into this recession, we only constitute 30% of all credit that's available. So in areas where loan volume has grown, for example, you heard about real estate lending, we actually welcome the opportunity for a lot of real estate lending to return to the traditional banking industry. And traditional banks are seeing good credits come into their bank, whether it's small businesses or individuals looking for a mortgage loan. But there's absolutely no way that the traditional banking industry is going to make up for that other 70% of the credit markets, that much of which went away in this current recession. And so, yeah, in part, there are good customers out there. Yes, businesses are struggling, but there are a lot of good credits out there, and they are coming into traditional banks. That is a place where they can still get credit. So it's allowing many of our banks to grow, not all of them. We didn't bring every bank in the state here, and there's certainly some that are challenged right now and loan volumes down. But overall, the traditional banking industry has seen some growth in credit. But again, the sectors of the economy that depended on the rest of the credit markets, they're continuing to see stress. And I would encourage my colleagues to add to that.
I would say, Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, mm-hmm. if you think about just the residential mortgage industry, if someone's looking to take out a mortgage loan right now, they're highly motivated to do that with an institution that has bricks and mortar and a physical presence in their community, and less likely to operate with an out-of-town, you know, entity where there's somebody who knows somebody with a laptop and access to a conduit funded by the capital markets. Because people have learned the hard way that if you hit troubled times, you want to be able to walk into a branch, sit down across the table from somebody, and talk it out. And some folks who dealt with an out-of-town entity that may not be in business right now are having a heck of a time finding somebody to talk through. So it is a market share issue. On the residential mortgage side, people are much more likely to come to a, quote, regular bank for a mortgage loan than they are to some sort of more exotic or esoteric institution.
And what got us into this trouble, you're the wrong people to come here and report on it. There was a lot of irresponsible borrowing, a lot of irresponsible lending, and I don't think the vast majority, didn't come out of banks. It came out of them other folks. God bless every one of them, but we were on a spending spree in this country, and the bill came due, and here we are. But I'm glad to see when everyone around you losing their head, it's important to keep yours. So I'm glad to hear there's stable heads out there keeping it going. And I appreciate the spectrum of the banks here, too. We have very relatively small to huge institutions. And where's your office at, sir?
In the Fox Tower.
Okay. Any more questions of these good people before I wrap up and thank the committee and everybody for the whole session? I really appreciate you coming down here. Don't be surprised if you're invited again over the interim. I think it can't hurt, and we'll invite some of them other. Maybe we'll just have a finance day in the Business and Labor Committee and invite a wide spectrum of lenders and people that use financing for whatever reason. Representative Matthews.
Mr. Chair, perhaps in the interim you can use your same powerful influence that got these nice folks come forward to get some of those people out there that are creating a bad name for the industry, and have them come forward maybe and explain their practice. But I'd also like to say that there's a lot of folks out there that really, to get into their dream house, to get into what they really wanted, to get it what they had, they felt compelled to please help me. And in a lot of cases, I think some good folks tried to help some really good people, and unfortunately it just didn't pan out. And we heard a lot of this, of course, this started in consumer protection. We heard a lot of stories throughout this session in consumer protection. And quite honestly, there's one thing that I continue to say, and that is sometimes you can't protect people from themselves. And so a lot of this has to do with personal responsibility, too. So I thank you for your time today, and thank you very much for coming forward. And this is kind of what we thought all along would probably happen. Thank you.
Well, this broad shoulder committee frequently bats cleanup around here, and that's what we're doing today. All righty. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And before you all go, this is for the committee, but and for all those, I want to thank all those who've had business before this committee this session. I have a sign down in the lobby room inviting everyone who had business and labor before the business and labor committee to come to the business and labor party tomorrow night. But I want to really thank these members, and I wish they were all here. We had quite a diverse group here. I'm pleasantly surprised at how wonderful we've worked together this session. I cannot tell you how happy I am with that, and that's each and every one of you. It's been a wonderful session. We've got a lot of work done. It was a lot of trying moments at times, but once again, we kept our heads. I want to thank Chair Witt for being the subcommittee chair. He just left, and that staff. I want to thank Tamsin for keeping the microphones off when I most definitely needed them off and on when I needed them on. I want to thank David Harrell, and once again, thank the members, but I am blessed with the best committee administrator in the state of Oregon and probably the Pacific Northwest and maybe this in the country, Teresa Van Winkle here. Without her, she's the smartest person in the room, whatever room she's in. And without her, this committee that has been saddled with a tremendous workload, she has just made everything run like clockwork around here, and she makes us all look good, and that's a big chore. So I just express my unending gratitude, Teresa. But thank you very much, folks, and hopefully I'll see you Thursday night, even if you're a little late.
Mr. Chair, attitude reflects leadership.
Well, thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Without anything, rest for the good of the group. We're adjourned.